want the Republicans to wake up is... What the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Coming up, you'll hear Trudy Lieberman, a veteran journalist who's covered consumer affairs and healthcare for almost 40 years. And she wrote the cover story on the July issue of Harper's Magazine, a critical look at Obamacare. And as you'll hear in a moment, I am declaring today that the partisan lockdown on honest criticism of Obamacare is over. If you're using Obamacare, I hope you'll listen and send me your comments about your own experience. And if you've considered Obamacare and decided not for any reason, I'd like you to share that as well. My personal email is peter@peterbcollins.com. And I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Teresa Jimenez just renewed her annual subscription. Thanks, Teresa. Craig Balog is here every month with $20. Wow, I appreciate that, too. And I noted over the weekend that Nick Yaksich has taken out a new monthly subscription. Nick, great to have you with us, and I appreciate your support. If you'd like to join them, come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the link under my picture that says Sign Up. That'll take you to the page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, a one-time contribution, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. There's also my post office box address there if you want to conduct your business with a check instead of using PayPal. I welcome your support, and I appreciate the hundreds of people who support me here every month. I am declaring that the partisan lockdown on honest discussion of Obamacare is over. Journalist Trudy Lieberman joins me today.
I don't need no doctor, 'cause I know what's ailing me.
I don't need no doctor, I got Obamacare.
I don't need no doctor, no, no, 'cause I know what's ailing me.
It's for-profit insurance companies that's ailing me.
Been too long away from my baby. I'm coming down with misery.
I don't need no doctor. I don't need
Trudy Lieberman is a journalist with 40-plus years of service. She's focused on health care for many years. She's written for Consumer Reports, writes regularly for the Columbia Journalism Review, and her article was featured with a huge front-page splash on the July issue of Harper's Magazine called Wrong Prescription, The Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. Trudy Lieberman, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And before we get into your important article, first of all, I want to thank the editors of Harper's for giving such prominent placement to your piece, including this, fold-over flap that they use on the newsstand to try to sell extra copies with a hot pull quote. I really appreciate that. And as I told you before we started recording, Trudy, I am declaring that based on your article and the recent Supreme Court decision that rescued the poor drafting of Obamacare once again, that we are now free to honestly criticize the Affordable Care Act. Because for the past few years, there has been this partisan skirmish, and there were only two sides. the Republicans who wanted to kill it and tried to repeal it 47 times with votes in the House, and the Democrats who reflexively had to defend it because it has their president's name on it. It's his signature domestic initiative. And while it sucks, they're able to spin it up as saying, well, this is much better than what we had before. And while there are some marginal improvements in terms, and while I'm pleased to see more people have gotten coverage, as your article points out, fundamentally, we have locked in the profit-taking corporate delivery of health insurance and the underlying health services in ways that are hugely problematic and do not provide affordable care or expand the coverage to the levels that we had hoped.
That's correct. That's exactly a very good summary of what I have written.
Mm-hmm. And so I do appreciate that in your article, you first of all open with a quote from Steny Hoyer, the number two Democrat in the House at the time that Speaker Pelosi was able to pass it with no Republican support, saying, you know, almost laughingly, we've got to pass the bill because nobody's read it before we passed it. And once we pass it, we'll have time to sit down and read it and see what's in it.
Yeah. That's sort of the mentality that was going on during the debate in 2009 and in early 2010 when this law was going through Congress. And certainly the press coverage that I was following very keenly at the time for the Columbia Journalism Review reflected that. And what we saw is the media sort of taking what the proponents of the law were feeding them and basically regurgitating that in their stories. And hence we got this notion about this quality, affordable care, affordable quality health care, which was the slogan that everybody was using. And they stayed on message, and they used it all the time. In fact, Obama still uses it. Mm-hmm. And he certainly did that a few weeks ago when the Supreme Court decision was announced. But I think what that did is make people believe they were getting something that they weren't. And when the Republicans came along and sort of poked holes in it and found out that, yeah, there was some more to this, that people sort of got angry. And I think that a lot of people today who have taken a considered look at this are looking at it and saying, I'm not sure this is really for me, and it's going to help me very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as we'll get into, I've been test driving Obamacare for myself and to share with my listeners here in California, and it's been a very rough ride. Now going back to the origins, I pulled up an infographic that's been circulating on Facebook, and it quotes the former Ohio Republican Senator George Voinovich, saying that back in 2009, Republicans were ordered to block everything that President Obama wanted, even if it was something that, you know, he was framing to appeal to Republicans using Republican think tank product, etc. And the quote is, if Obama wanted it, we Republicans had to be against it. And this has created this partisan divide where it's impossible to have a rational discussion about the failings in the Affordable Care Act and my desire to improve it. I believe we're stuck with it. I'm a single-payer person, and you know, I hear Bernie Sanders talking about that, and he sings to me when he says that. But getting from here to there will be very difficult. And in the meantime, I think there's some significant defects that can be fixed or at least addressed if we have honest debates about that.
Well, I think we can deal with some of the more glaring problems, but I think that we are very, very far from ever dealing with the basic problem in this law, and which has been plaguing our healthcare system for some time now, and which has prevented us from getting any kind of a national health insurance program like all the rest of the world has, the developed world anyway, and that is the lack of cost control, mm-hmm. lack of containment, cost containment. And that has always been the stumbling block in this country, going back to the days of Harry Truman and before that. And in those days, it was the doctors and the life insurance companies, which were selling, I guess, whatever kind of health insurance products were being sold then. And then, of course, the Blue Cross plans in the 1930s and then afterwards. And then the medical establishment. And they never, ever wanted any kind of control because they didn't want their profits hurt. And that has been with us since the beginning. I mean, when I have taught this in classes and I have 20-something students ask me about socialized medicine, I say, well, you know, where did you get that term? Because they certainly weren't around when this term was used. They weren't even born yet. And it's just so much part and ingrained in our thinking and our psyche. And it's a problem because this law has virtually no cost containment in it that's going to work and do anything in the long term. It has some provisions for these accountable care organizations that are supposed to allow insurance companies to partner with medical groups so that they can provide more coordinated care and save money. But these are little isolated examples of mm-hmm. things that might happen, and nobody knows if they're going to work. And so that's the basic problem, and I don't see that being fixed anytime soon.
And Trudy, at the base of this is this idea that Obama was so desperate to get Republican votes, and they denied him any meaningful support in both houses of Congress, that he adopted these right-wing proposals that came out of conservative think tanks. And as I'm saying, it has locked in the corporate control of the healthcare system and the profit-taking component, particularly in the insurance zone. And to me, this is the biggest fundamental flaw. Do you see ways that we can move public opinion and move the Congress to expand Medicare, at least to provide some competition for the services that are now channeled through the for-profit insurance companies?
I know that a lot of people would like to see that happen, and certainly during the debate on the bill, there was a time when some people thought they were going to get a public option, a government-run insurance apparatus to compete with the private carriers, and at one point they thought they might be able to ratchet down the age of Medicare eligibility to 55 and allow people 55 up to 65 to buy into Medicare, which of course was envisioned when Medicare was passed, because even Lyndon Johnson, with all of his great political skills, was not able to get national health insurance. And I think that that was what was hoped. But I'm afraid that that is not going to happen in the near future for the following reason, and I'm going to be dealing with this in another piece. And that's what's happening to Medicare. We are on a road to increasing privatization of Medicare, and this has been going on for some time now, and certainly through the Medicare Advantage plans, where most people, not most, a lot of the Medicare beneficiaries are right now, because these plans are being overpaid by the government very generously, and they can offer no premium plans, and that's very helpful to seniors on fixed incomes. So what's happening is a move to privatizing Medicare and allowing or making Medicare beneficiaries who are not going into those Medicare Advantage plans to assume more of the cost of their care. And that is the crux of Obamacare, that there has been a huge cost shift from payers like employers mm-hmm. to individuals and workers. And I think at some point we should talk about that, because this great cost shift is really, really important, and I don't think it was discussed very much at all during the debate. But Medicare is becoming like that, mm-hmm. and there's a move in Congress to make people pay as much as $6,000 out of pocket before their Medigap insurance pays. So to answer your question, I don't think we're going to go there anytime soon.
And would you agree that the for-profit approach to healthcare delivery is fatally flawed?
Well, it would seem so. In other countries, they do have some private provisioning of care, but everybody is covered. The insurance, there's not much private insurance. And I think that there may be, like in Britain, for example, some people can buy private insurance and opt out of the NHS, but not all that many do that. In other countries, there may be some arrangements to do that, but I think, by and large, most people stay within their national health systems because everybody's in the risk pool, and it makes it possible to provide care for large numbers of people, and people do get sick. And when you have a skewed risk pool like we have now, you've got a lot of sick people coming into those Obamacare policies, and the rates are going to go up.
Mm-hmm.
That's inevitable.
We're talking with Trudy Lieberman, her cover story in Harper's Magazine, the July issue, is a fascinating look at Obamacare called Wrong Prescription. And Trudy, in the article, you set up your frame by talking about the history of the Republicans, mostly, who have pushed for more powerful consumers, imagining that people who are sick are in a position to, steer their health care dollars in ways that will reshape the system. And you talk about the Indianapolis insurance tycoon Patrick Rooney, who championed what were called medical savings accounts, and then they were renamed health savings accounts. And you say that about 26 million people currently use HSAs. I've never availed myself of that, so I'm not too familiar with it. But you use this to set the stage for your discussion of the great cost shift. And before I ask you to describe that in some detail for our listeners, I'd just like to frame it as part of the unraveling of the New Deal. Because first we saw the shift from defined benefit pensions that were fully paid by employers, or at least originally they were, along with health care coverage that was fully paid by the employer. And as people, during the 90s, despite the claims of the Clinton economic boom, there were millions of Americans who lost permanent jobs and were rehired as contractors with lesser benefits. And at the same time, this transition began to wean people off of defined benefit pensions and replace them with these risky 401ks, many of which were heavily loaded with stocks in the company that the person worked for. And so I see this erosion of the New Deal as a long-term effort that I would lay at the feet of Ronald Reagan and his big thinkers back in the 1980s. So with that, talk about the great cost shift as you describe it, and if you care to, put it in the bigger frame that I just outlined.
Well, I agree with you. I think this destruction of defined benefit plans has been going on clearly since the early 80s, because I wrote a lot about this when I was at Consumer Reports at that time. And one could see that people were beginning to lose that fundamental help that they got in retirement. And that has pretty much been eroded, and clearly the IRAs are no substitute for a defined benefit plan for anybody, unless you're fabulously wealthy, which most people are not. And I think that was sort of the beginning of it, but I think that was in the 80s. And Rooney came along in the early 90s and began to use his own money to shift to these HSA accounts. And at the beginning, everybody thought this was this really screwball idea that was never going to go anywhere. And then gradually, the Democrats bought into this and first authorized a demonstration program for these HSAs, which was really the proverbial nose under the camel's tent, or the camel's nose under the tent. And what was happening there is that once they were allowed, even on a demonstration basis, it wasn't very long before they were allowed totally, and that came in 2003 under George Bush as a way to get the drug benefit for seniors. That was sort of a quid pro quo, that they would allow these HSAs. They were renamed and got other goodies to go along with them, but essentially that's what brought them into the fold. And so in the end, Pat Rooney really did win, and he totally changed the health insurance arrangements that most of us grew up with, which was the basic Blue Cross plan, and you got 80% of everything covered and paid the other 20%, which in the 1960s and 70s wasn't really very much money, so people just paid it and moved on. But they had security, and that has changed. And so now what you have is this great cost shift that, since we haven't controlled our costs very well, we're going to make the the person who has the insurance pay all those costs. And, of course, that's tantamount to a tax on the sick, because if you don't use your policy, you're not going to pay those costs, right? But if you're sick, you're going to have all those costs shoved on you.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who are sick and perhaps the least able to afford it are going to bear the brunt of this.
And you know, tied with this was the reform of the bankruptcy laws, despite the clear statistics that the prime driver of families into bankruptcy is unexpected huge health care bills. And so the way that the working families in this country have been hammered as the social safety net has been dismantled in the interests of corporate profits is a stunning shift in the last 30 to 40 years.
Yes, that's exactly what's happened, and it's gone on without much pushback from the public, which I find, as someone who's covered this practically my whole career and saw how useful these supports were and are to families, to see them sort of going away without much pushback. And from young people today, I often hear them say, when I say, I don't think, you know, you're going to have Medicare like we have, what are you going to do for health care? You know, you're not going to have a defined benefit plan. What are you going to do? And they say, well, we're going to save everything. You know, I'm not counting on it. And then Social Security is another one where it's under attack. So the young people say to me, I guess I just have to save. I'm not counting on this. But I don't hear any outrage coming from them saying, you know, we have to do something about it, or we have to organize, or we have to talk to members of Congress. Instead, it's more of a resignation, and I find that really rather astonishing.
Well, and for a moment, let me ask you to put on the hat you wear when you're writing for the Columbia Journalism Review, because I think the media has been complicit in this. A simple shift that's very obvious is that the business page in, you know, major daily newspapers once covered businesses the way they covered other news stories. You know, if bad things happened, they'd write critical reports. If good things happened, they'd write nice reports. But mostly business reporting now is hagiography of CEOs. Sometimes there are exclamations about how much CEOs are paid and the bald-faced comparisons to the line workers at the company where that CEO is extracting huge amounts for himself. And there's very little critical reporting of the bad decisions that business makes and the, you know, huge shifts that you're describing at least a major component of.
No, I don't see much reporting on that at all. And we had an example of this around Christmas time when there was a budget bill going through Congress. It was one of these must-do bills that they had to do before the first of the year. And there were some amendments added to it that came from actually a former member of Congress from California who had been on labor side that actually took away some of the pension benefits from people already receiving them in certain kinds of employer plans. And the reporting on that was just pretty outrageous. It was the media just sort of parroting back what the supporters of this legislation were saying.
And go ahead and name the name there. Who is this former member of Congress?
George
Miller?
Yeah.
Really?
George Miller, yeah. I believe he was very instrumental in crafting that legislation.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't write about the politics of that. I wrote about the consequences and mm-hmm. what the press was covering at the time, and they certainly really were not explaining this very clearly to all those people who were going to get their benefits literally taken away from them. So you would get X dollars in your pension check, and then after a while you're going to get Y dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And the way this was sold was to preserve the corpus for future beneficiaries, and this was the only way they could do it. And so I was just absolutely astonished by that, because it was another example of this sort of diminution of these benefit supports that had been in place that have given people a fighting chance.
Well, I know George Miller, and I have a generally favorable opinion. I'm not happy to hear this, and next time I see him, I'll bring it up and see what he has to say.
Yes, do that.
Trudy, you focus in part of your piece about the so-called Cadillac tax, And I have to say, I scratched my head at the time that this was described in the bill and, you know, in the committee hearings that were held. But it always seemed odd to me that you would sell an insurance policy and then tax that expenditure. That just seems like a double taxation in a way that is completely nonsensical. And you're now describing how far more people are interested in or using these so-called Cadillac plans, and either they or their employer have to end up paying a premium, an extra tax, in order to allow them to buy this top-flight insurance.
That's right. That's exactly what's happened. And there are economists who have been after this for a long time, and they've thought for economic reasons it's inefficient and unfair and blah, blah, blah. But the real reason for this, there were really two reasons. One, it was a revenue generator to pay for the subsidies under Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does not get repealed, and there's an effort underway by businesses and others to try to get this repealed, and some of the unions are involved in that. If it does not, the main reason will be that the Congress needs the money that it will generate
mm-hmm.
in order to pay for the subsidies for people who were previously uninsured. So that's one of the reasons. But the other reason, and this was not stated overly clearly, and certainly not by Jonathan Gruber, who was a big proponent of this, that this is also a cost containment measure. And the idea behind it is that if we take away your good insurance, you won't go to the doctor as much, and you will forego treatment. And if you forego enough treatment, and everybody collectively foregoes enough treatment, the national health care tab will come down.
But Trudy, this is absolutely...
Remember that volume times price, volume of services times the price of the medical service equals the national health care tab. So the idea is that if you make people go to the doctor less because they have to pay out of pocket, and there is some evidence that that does happen. People will not go to the doctor even when they need to go. So what will happen then is that people will forego care even when they need it, and maybe the price will come down, maybe it won't. But what we've seen before, at least in the Medicare program, is that whenever there was a cost control put on doctors, they just increased the volume and did more procedures. So I think that this was not explained well. It was not thought through. It was an expedient provision because it gave them the revenue they needed without raising a whole lot of taxes. And now we're stuck with it. And I think people who will be affected by it don't know what's going to happen to them in the next couple of years, because it's not just people on Wall Street who have these so-called Cadillac plans. I've had one all my career, and I certainly didn't work on Wall Street. It will affect retirees who have policies from their employers that had good insurance. It will be people in unionized industries. It will just be people all over. And I think as the person from the national business group that I talked to said, that people just don't know what's coming, but after a while, it's going to affect nearly everyone.
And isn't it directly in contradiction with the fundamentals we were told underlie the conceptual part of the Affordable Care Act, that we got to get people out of the emergency rooms and get them, you know, from forestalling preventive or even first stage intervention. And of course, when you put out of pocket costs either on the insurance itself or the doctor visit, that discourages people. And then when they finally do get to the doctor, the situation is, commonly more complicated. A disease might be farther along, and the remedies will be more costly.
Well, that's exactly right. But I think that your point on the emergency room is well taken. That was the rhetoric surrounding the law. Certainly, you know, it sounded good on television. You know, we're going to give people insurance, they're going to go to the family doctor, and, you know, they're not going to go into this expensive care setting. But the dirty little secret is they will still do that, and they are still doing it. And even as this law was being passed, some of the hospitals were being revving up to advertise their emergency room services using it because it's a profit center, because the reimbursements are so high for people who go. And so I think even the latest research is showing that there has been really no reduction in emergency rooms use, mm-hmm. and probably won't be anything meaningful.
Now, Trudy, I'd like to briefly share with you my own experiences with Obamacare through the Covered California Exchange here. In the first year, I signed up for a platinum plan that was roughly comparable to the union coverage that I had enjoyed for many years. And the price tag was $400 a month more. And before I bought the plan from Anthem Blue Cross, I talked to my primary care physician and confirmed that he believed he was in the Anthem Blue Cross network. And I also quizzed the person at Covered California who signed me up. And in the as soon as I got my coverage, I called Anthem Blue Cross and I confirmed that my doctor was believed to be in their network. So I went in for a physical. The bill came, and Anthem Blue Cross said, your doctor is not in our network. And they'd billed me for double the amount that I had expected to pay for the physical. And so when I finally got through all of the bullshit, pardon me, what I discovered was that I was a second-class insured. I was in the lower tier of a two-tier system, and that Anthem Blue Cross had proscribed, eliminated, most of the doctors in their network from being available to me. I was in a narrowed network. And I'll give you one example. I needed some care from a dermatologist. So I go to the Anthem Blue Cross website. I give them my zip code. They give me, it spits out five or six doctors. I called each one of them. Not a single one of them honored the coverage that I had. And so I went through a lengthy appeal process through Covered California. I finally got them to allow me to leave Anthem Blue Cross, but it was at the end of the calendar year, so it was a whole waste of time on my part. So now I've switched over to Kaiser, which I don't believe gives me the kind of coverage I had with my primary care physician and the union coverage 4 years ago. But it's a much safer bet than Anthem Blue Cross, which, despite its lousy coverage of me in the first year, announced that it was going to increase my premiums by 16% if I had continued with them. So I just wanted to briefly, you know, it makes me feel better to share this, and I think there are listeners who will say, wow, I'm not the only one who got shoved into a narrowed network. But these were not disclosed to us when we signed up for these policies. And when I filed my appeal, I alleged fraud. And this administrative law judge who heard my appeal declined the fraud charge. But to me, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but it was a circumstantial case where I bought something and was given something far inferior.
This has been going on not just in California, and it's been a big problem in California, but it's been a big problem in New York. It's been a problem all over the country. And what insurance companies are doing is offering these very limited networks as another cost control device. And the reasoning goes like this, that if we only play ball with certain doctors and hospitals, like low-cost doctors and low-cost hospitals, then we'll be able to keep our insurance premiums lower and get a bigger piece of the market. It's all about marketing, and market competition is what it really boils down to. So there's all this stuff that's happened to people. They've gotten caught with these really humongous bills, and not just for, you know, routine dermatology. I mean, big, big surgeries and all kinds of things. And so what's happened after that is that, at least in New York, there's been some legislation passed. It's certainly not perfect, and I know it's being discussed in California. But the rest of the country really hasn't moved in that direction. So you've got the consumer advocacy groups giving all this sort of standard advice. Well, call the plan, call your doctor. Well, you know, that only goes so far, because some of the plans drop the doctors, and some of the doctors don't know which plans they're in, or their staffs don't know which plans they're in. And it's becoming a very big bureaucratic mess. One could argue the typical, you know, old-fashioned consumer solution would have been, oh, well, let's pass a law, and we'll pass a law, and we'll be able to help people out. Well, maybe to some degree you can, but basically, this is a limiting of choice, and choice was one of the big reasons for the passage of the law. Remember, you can keep your doctor. That's what the president told us. Well, you can't keep your doctor. And now the mantra from many of these groups is that, well, you know, you're just going to have to make choice. You want to pay more money for a wide-open network and go to the best or the most expensive, not necessarily the best, but
right.
maybe most expensive cancer treatment centers in your area, which tend to be eliminated in some of these narrow networks, or a very expensive children's hospital, for example. That's
mm-hmm.
another one that's often not in. Or do you want to pay a lower premium? And I don't think that's what people bargained for when this law was being passed. I don't think they knew anything about it. They remembered the slogans, they're going to get affordable quality health care, and the president promised $2,500 savings for every family. Perhaps you remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is that some people did lose their coverage. The Republicans were not entirely wrong here. Some people did lose their coverage, and they
yeah.
lost what they thought was good coverage for them. And you know, that had to happen because of the minimum benefit standards that all these new policies had. But I think this narrow network problem is really beginning to be an issue because it is limiting people and it's sticking them with some very expensive bills that they hadn't bargained on.
Right. And I just want to underscore that I intentionally bought the top of the line, the platinum coverage. Because,
I heard that.
Because I wanted to, you know, make sure that I wasn't signing up for higher deductibles and those sorts of things. And you made a comment earlier about how some of the doctors, you know, declined. That's what it turned out happened with my primary care. His office manager later told me that they tried to hammer him for much lower reimbursements for a patient like me. And he simply said no. And so none of that was disclosed to me during this process, and there's arrogance, and there's also just this kind of approach that they've got the volume. They've been shoveled, you know, millions of new clients with huge government subsidies, and they don't care about Peter B. You know, I mean, they've got plenty of people lined up behind me to pay the same premium for the same shitty coverage.
Yeah, well, one thing they haven't disclosed necessarily is that there's tiering within the platinum and the gold and the bronze. So a silver policy, for example, may be having three tiers within a silver plan, or the bronze plan may have two tiers. So this adds another level of complexity in the selection of a policy, which is really difficult. I've helped people here in New York do it, and it's extremely hard.
Mm-hmm. And Trudy, on July 3rd, the Times, New York Times, ran a story. Health insurance companies around the country are seeking rate increases of 20% to 40%, saying the new customers under the Affordable Care Act turned out to be sicker than expected. Now, this is so insulting.
What a surprise.
Because we knew what the pool would look like. And this, again, you know, just demands expansion of Medicare or some other single-payer approach. Because Medicare would be a better pool and a lower risk if they included younger people. And Medicare would be solvent for a longer period of time projected forward if they covered more people. And, of course, if they fix the ACA problem with the ban on negotiating for discounts on the bulk purchase of prescription drugs. And so there are many ways that we could achieve some control, but that's not being exercised. Instead, you know, there's going to be a public battle. And when, you know, Blue Shield asks for 36% in Tennessee, maybe they'll dial that back to 25% and come away smiling. But there is no meaningful approach to limiting these increases. And this is pretty stunning stuff, where 54% in Minnesota, and I believe that's a state where Anthem controls over 80% of the market. Am I correct?
Yeah. Blue Cross is the big carrier in Minnesota. That's
okay.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
No, this is absolutely happening, and I'm going to be looking into this in the next couple of weeks. And it is clearly an issue, and we've seen the final rates in Oregon, and some of those companies are getting very high increases. And, yes, a lot of sicker people came into the risk pool, but we knew that was going to happen because there are no restrictions on policies now are on medical
pre-existing
conditions. But that's because you don't have everybody in the pool, and under a different system you would.
Mm-hmm. So as you look at this picture, Trudy, where can I steer my listeners who are concerned about this? Many of them may be in the same position I am, where they see, you know, a diminution in the quality of the care with an increase in the price. And it appears this pattern is going to continue. And we've got this partisan problem in Washington that I addressed at the outset of our conversation here. And apart from Bernie Sanders, who, you know, I support and recognize that he may not end up being the Democratic nominee, I appreciate that he is articulating this, but it's not as if he's getting a groundswell of support on the, you know, specific issue of health care.
I think the people are going to have to make their concerns known, and they're going to have to do it forcefully and loudly. One woman in Wyoming wrote to me last week, and she said, "I'll tell you why we are not buying an Obamacare policy. It's just not affordable for us." And she was articulate, she was smart, she'd done her homework, she looked at all the policies, and she said the ones for her family were $700 to $800 a month, and even with a subsidy, she would have to pay $400 to $500, and she said, "We just can't put that into the budget. It's cheaper for us to take the penalty." And I think that there have to be more people who are going to voice their concerns about this and their concerns about the narrow networks and the lack of choice. And perhaps many of these people will end up in bankruptcy court. Remember, this law was supposed to change all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think until that happens, it's going to be very difficult to make any changes.
Well, Trudy, I want to thank you for the work that you've been doing for so long and this important article in Harper's. And where is the best place that people can follow your work online?
They can follow me on Columbia Journalism Review and on Twitter sometimes at Trudy_Lieberman.
Okay.
And but mostly I write for the Columbia Journalism Review, The Second Opinion, and I also write for a blog site called Health News Review.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Trudy, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and as I said, I really appreciate the work you've been doing.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, since I'm on Obamacare, I'm just glad I haven't gotten sick. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until